Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A top Taliban military commander was captured and is being questioned in Pakistan. U.S. Marines are leading a massive NATO effort to drive insurgents from southern Afghanistan and transfer power in the region to the government of Afghanistan. Joining me to talk about U.S. strategy in Afghanistan, David Sanger. He's chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, and Carl Inderfirth. He's former assistant secretary of state for South Asian affairs and professor at George Washington University's School of International Affairs. We are going to take your calls. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I look forward to seeing your tweets, your messages on Facebook. And now joining us by phone from Kabul is Rod Norland of the New York Times. He's been covering the Marja offensive. Good morning to you, Rod.
Good morning.
Glad to have you with us. Rod, the news this morning is very much on the capture of a top Taliban military leader who had been in Karachi. What can you tell us about him?
Well, I didn't cover that myself, so I can only tell you what I read in the New York Times. But apparently he's the second most important Taliban leader, and he was arrested a few days ago. Our reporters heard about it and held it back for a while at the request of the government so they wouldn't endanger any ongoing intelligence operations. Today, the Taliban spokesman very angrily denied that that he's actually in custody and claims he's still in Afghanistan and still directing their military operations.
So what connection would you make if indeed his capture has been affected? What would you make, how would you make the connection between his capture and the offensive taking place in Marja?
I think it's difficult to make an offensive. I don't think that he would have been in Marja himself, although it is the Taliban's most important stronghold in terms of a place where they have a fairly large population or had a large population under their control. Senior commanders of his level spend most of their time in Pakistan. That's widely known. So more than likely, it was a coincidence. I mean, there's a lot of the possibility that they managed to capture somebody that they got intelligence on operation.
I'm afraid this line is going. Rod Norland of the New York Times, I want to thank you for joining us. I'm afraid our listeners would have a very difficult time with this line. We'll talk to you another time. David Sanger, turning to you. As Rod Norland said, this news was held back for 5 days. Tell me what was going on here in Washington, there in Pakistan, as this capture was apparently underway, which now the Taliban is denying.
First, I should say the story was broken by Mark Mazzetti, a colleague of mine and Rod's, who's our intelligence reporter, and Dexter Filkins, who were in Kabul. And, you know, for all that we have talked over the years about mainstream media and all that you hear back and forth, this is part of the reason you have mainstream media, because get out and break stories. They did a fabulous job with this. At the same time, when the government heard that the Times was on to the story, there were requests that the story be held for a while.
From whom?
From the White House, because they were still getting live intelligence from from the presumably from the interrogation, and perhaps from those trying to communicate with him. It's not clear to us when the Taliban recognized that he had been captured.
What do you make of the denials that the Taliban is issuing today?
Not a whole lot. I mean, usually what we have seen in the past, particularly in cases when Taliban leaders have been killed, is that there have been denials for a while that the individual was killed, and then you learn a few weeks later that he was. Now, you can't completely dismiss it. I mean, it's conceivable, I imagine, that there's a case of mistaken identity. But from everything I have heard about this case, I would be highly doubtful. I think they've got the person that they think they have in Mr. Barter. He is the he was sort of the military day-to-day tactical and strategic person working under Mullah Omar. And the significance of this is that until now, the Pakistanis have been willing to go after and arrest or kill Pakistani Taliban who are aiming at the government in Islamabad. But they have been very reluctant to go after the Afghan Taliban who are living in Pakistan, who they did not regard as their problem. They regarded these as the American problem. The fact that the ISI has gone out in cooperation with the U.S., and it'd be interesting to hear the story, I don't know it, of what the nature of that cooperation was, and capture a senior leader of the Afghan Taliban could indicate that the Pakistanis have had some change of heart. And that's what everyone has been waiting for many years now.
David Sanger, he's chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. He's the author of the book titled The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. Turning to you now, Carl Inderfirth, can we know what is happening there now in terms of any kind of intelligence we would hope to get from this man?
Well, I think this is a major development, and I think that we have all been looking to see a few breaks come the way of the U.S. and the international community. This may be one of those moments. He is not number one. Mullah Omar is still number one, and he is the ideological chief, but apparently Mullah Baradar is the war commander. So bringing him, capturing him, is an important development. And it, again, as David was just saying, it indicates, we think, that there is greater cooperation with the Pakistani ISI, the intelligence. We've always seen Afghanistan as dependent upon progress being made in Pakistan, and this could be an indication of that. So it's a major development, and that, along with the major military offensive going on in Marja, suggests that maybe the stars are coming into some alignment there where things are moving in the direction that President Obama and General McChrystal say we've got 12 to 18 months to accomplish.
What kind of information would we be after from this man? And what in the world makes us believe he would tell us the secrets behind the Taliban?
Well, the Taliban, we believe, is from 20 to 25,000 strong in Afghanistan, and he would know that network. He would know their deployments. He would know where they are. Now, whether or not he would provide that information, but it would be disruptive of their operations. And it also plays into something that's going on. Everyone realizes that Afghanistan is not simply a military solution. There has to be a political component to it. And there's a lot of discussion right now about reconciliation, which is what President Karzai is saying, reconciling with the Taliban leadership if they will come in from the cold, if you will, and a lot of talk about reintegration of lower-level Afghan Taliban fighters. $140 million was allocated at the London conference to pursue that. So this plays into that whole setting. If you take down the number two, maybe he'll provide information. There's been some allegations that he is a moderate Taliban. Now, when I was in office, I met with Taliban, and I never found a moderate one in my dealings, but maybe he is one of those. So it opens up doors, and it also disrupts.
David Sanger.
You know, Diane, when I was working on The Inheritance, one of President Bush's senior aides said to me that sometimes when you capture people like this, you know, it's less like the interrogations you see in the movies and more like CSI, because when you capture somebody, sometimes the forces are lucky enough to get their cell phones, their computers, all those kinds of things. And so even while the interrogation's going on, and it may or may not yield something, the really important thing is if you can follow back the tracks of digital messages, of text messaging, of cell phone numbers, and try to act on that very quickly, sometimes before the people at the other end of those cell phones or computers know that the individual they are communicating with has been captured. That can frequently be the best moment to exploit information.
I've been interested in hearing again and again that this was a joint operation between the CIA and NATO and Pakistani forces. Is that indeed the case? Did the CIA have the lead in this operation? How can we know? David Sanger?
I don't know yet. And, you know, it usually takes a little while,
before
you get a moment to go debrief the people who were involved. And then sometimes they'll tell you and sometimes they won't.
How many CIA people do we have on the ground there?
I don't know, but I would assume a fairly large. There's a significant station in Islamabad.
David Sanger, he's chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He is the author of The Inheritance: The World Obama Confronts, The Challenges to American Power. When we come back, we'll talk to the former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan. And joining us now from Washington, Zalmay Khalilzad, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan and now counselor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Good morning to you, Mr. Ambassador. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. It's great to be with you again.
Thank you. Tell me about your own perspective on the Obama administration's strategy in Afghanistan and whether you believe the administration and the Karzai government are now on the same page.
I think overall the administration's effort to conduct a counterinsurgency strategy and focus on protecting the people is very positive, given that the nature of the insurgency in Afghanistan. I think also the emphasis on Pakistan and Afghanistan is positive because there has been a sanctuary for the Taliban in Pakistan for some time. But in terms of relations with President Karzai, there has been a problem for the past year. Karzai has believed that some of the people in the administration have sought to get rid of him by encouraging his opponents. I'm hoping that in the aftermath of the elections, they were that mistrust can be reduced and an effective partnership can be established between the administration and President Karzai, because each side needs the other in order to succeed.
David Sanger of the New York Times has a question for you.
Good morning, Ambassador Khalilzad. As you and I have discussed sometimes in the past, during the Bush administration, and certainly when you served, you know, the mantra was clear, build, hold. And now the mantra is clear, build, hold, and transfer. Transfer over to the Afghan forces and to the Afghan government. We heard General McChrystal, when he was briefing reporters last week, say that when this current operation is concluded, or at least the military phase of it is concluded in Marja, that there was a government in a box ready to roll, in other words, to provide services to the Afghans and make it territory that the Taliban would not come in and be able to reclaim. Tell me if you think that's possible. Are the Afghans up to that? What's a government in a box look like?
Well, the government in a box probably means they've got people assigned to different functions of government, the district governor, the district financial officer, the district judge, and what have you, that they would deploy as soon as the area has been cleared. The question is whether in reality, once they do become operational, they do deal effectively with the problems of the local population in terms of providing services, the rule of law, and what have you. And that is critical to win the hearts and minds of the people and to change the momentum that has been talked about, that has been going in parts of the South and East against the government and the coalition in recent times.
How successful do you believe this current offensive to be, Mr. Ambassador?
Well, it is likely to be successful in terms of clearing this relatively small area in Helmand, which was a stronghold of the Taliban. And the question is, can that be consolidated, that clearing, by having the government established and long-term security be established, and then that is expanded to additional areas in Helmand and beyond? But I think as a military operation, given the forces arrayed, it is very, very likely, almost certain, that it will succeed in its immediate objective.
The fact of the matter is that the Marines on the ground are encountering IEDs. They're encountering some gunfire. They're encountering certain dangers. If you clear the Marja area, how likely is it that the Taliban would simply move to another nearby area and create yet another stronghold?
Oh, that is very likely, of course. Where we're not there, that's where the insurgency will go. And the longer-term, of course, solution is clearing Afghanistan, the south and east generally, from the insurgency by military means, and then political dealings with local commanders and with the insurgency as a whole. But for the latter to happen, I believe that what you discussed earlier, the development in Pakistan, could be critical. If Pakistan has changed its approach, which is has been to provide sanctuary for the Taliban, if it is no longer willing to do that and is willing to move against the Taliban, I think that would have a very decisive positive effect on the insurgency in Afghanistan.
I think Carl Enderforth has a question for you.
Well, first I want to say hello to Zal and mention that I had an opportunity to see President Karzai myself 3 weeks ago in Kabul and talk to him about his difficulties that he had had with the Obama administration. And he told me as we were leaving that that's behind us now, So I think that there is a sense that moving forward, not looking backward, there were some difficult moments, but I think that that is important, particularly after London, and now we see the developments taking place. But I would like to ask Zal about the question of reconciliation and reintegration, the issue of how do you bring along the Taliban, bring them into the fold and get his sense of that, because there does seem to be some differences between the Karzai approach and the U.S. approach, and do you believe, Zal, that there are reconcilable leaders of the Taliban?
First, on your first point, I think you are right, but I think there is some residual mistrust that is still is there. I saw him just a few days ago in Munich, and I've dealt with these issues for some time. I think it will take some time to get over that period of mistrust. But it is very important that what you say is achieved. Second, on the issue of reconciliation and reintegration, I think both are condition-based or contingent. With regard to reintegration, which means integrating local commanders and leaders into the fold, I think the key thing is to have a secure environment where the local leaders, and there are factions inside the movement, can feel secure if they change sides. As long as there isn't security provided locally, be very difficult for them to change sides in an enduring way, maybe because of money and some immediate needs, tactically they could shift, but not strategically. I think this is a point where this integration has been the point of focus of our military and political leaders in Afghanistan. President Karzai has been focused on more of a national reconciliation, which is to come to some understanding with the leadership of the Taliban movement. And that, in my view, also is a condition contingent, and the conditions that favor reconciliation would be those where the insurgency is losing, either because of changes on the ground in Afghanistan or because it loses the sanctuary in Pakistan. Karzai has been reaching out to the Saudis in the hope that they would influence Pakistan to change their policy on the sanctuary. But there is a difference in emphasis between us and Karzai, but they can be reinforcing. They're not necessarily in contradiction with each other.
And one final question from David Sanger, Mr. Ambassador.
Mr. Ambassador, I just wanted to pursue this interesting point you were raising here about what you call the difference in emphasis, and what I think many Americans and British officials I talk to call a complete difference in strategy. The U.S. government and the British government seem willing to support a reintegration of the foot soldiers, those who have joined the Taliban in order to basically have a way to live and get a regular paycheck and a place to eat. But it strikes me just from the conversations with them that the leadership of the U.S. and Britain are unwilling to go up and try this with Mullah Omar or the other senior leaders. And they believe that they have too much blood on their hands and, as you suggest, may not truly be willing to reconcile in any case.
So, David, what you're suggesting is paying these people off.
Well, paying off the foot soldiers for sure, but one thing I would love to hear the ambassador's opinion on here is whether or not we are going to come to an agreement with President Karzai about how high up the Taliban leadership you attempt this.
Well, I think that would be when push comes to shove, that would be where the rubber meets the road. But I think at this point, we are so far from having any, in my judgment, prospects for reconciliation with the leadership that it isn't an immediate issue. I think President Karzai understands that it would take an extraordinary change in Pakistan policy for that to occur. And so far, his conditions are similar to ours, which is that reconciliation has to be based on accepting the Afghan constitution, breaking ties with terrorists, and living in peace in Afghanistan. And in private, he does emphasize that there are individuals that would have to be excluded. And I think those individuals and the people that we are concerned about, there is a great deal of overlap. But I think that the tactical reintegration has greater prospects locally in the near term. But the reason I thought they can be compatible is that as the reintegration succeeds, pressure on the Taliban leadership will grow for a reconciliation effort. The conditions, frankly, for a national reconciliation are not there at the moment.
All right. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Zalmay Khalilzad, former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, now counselor at Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you again, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones in just a moment. Join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. We do have a caller in Bethesda who's been waiting. Let's go to Justin. Good morning, sir. You're on the air.
Good morning to you. My question is, from the limited civilian perspective, it appears that combat operations in Afghanistan have largely been led by Marine forces. Is this a mistaken view? And if it's not, does this represent a strategic shift from operations in previous years in Afghanistan where the Army may have taken the lead?
David.
Well, certainly in Marja, the Marines have come in. You know, the Marines had been in Iraq and viewed themselves as being considerably underused, and they were moved over to Afghanistan. And this is some of the heaviest fighting, I think, that Marine units have seen in Afghanistan.
Here is an email from North Carolina from Rusty, who says, where is the Taliban getting their weapons from? It's been over 8 years. They have to resupply from someplace. Carl Enderforth.
That country has been awash in weaponry going back for 30 years, going back to during the Soviet occupation, going back to the Civil War. They
and
have
you're
money.
Saying it still operates.
It still operates. They can get arms from around the world. That is not a problem that they have.
Would you agree with that, David, that the arms are not new arms? They're just really have been there for years and years.
A lot of them have been there for years and years. Some were American supplied during the war against the Soviet occupation, and some of those are still around. But let's also remember that the Taliban have a considerable amount of money. They have it from, in part, the drug trade and the taxes and tolls that they managed to put on a lot of these roads and supply lines. And they have an incredible ability still to buy weapons in Pakistan and move them up in convoys, you know, in secret. And one of the big efforts that the U.S. has attempted is to try to cut off the movement not only of fighters, but of arms as well across the Pakistani border.
Here's a question we've had many times. This person said, this is a huge gamble by the administration. I feel the odds are short on success. We are invaders in their country. It cannot be settled with guns and rockets. Buying the opium harvest outright seems the best option to win in this area. Carl?
Fortunately, we're not seen as invaders. That has been the experience since 2001 when we went in to oust the Taliban. The Afghans still support a foreign military presence, NATO and the U.S. One reason that was being called into question was the issue of civilian casualties, and General McChrystal made it very clear that that would be a top priority to reduce civilian casualties to the lowest possible point, which has also come up in the issue of Marja. But I would say that in terms of the United States, its new strategy, this is the first time also since 2001 where the U.S. has been fully engaged and fully resourced, or at least adequately resourced. For a very long time, Afghanistan was a sideshow to the conflict in Iraq. Now there is a full attention being paid by the U.S. As well as the international community. So we'll see if the strategy works. Again, there's a 12 to 18-month window that most people say, if it doesn't show progress then we have real problems.
Carl Landerfirth, former Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Affairs. He's Professor and Graduate Program Director at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. We'll take just a short break. Your calls, emails, comments when we return.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, celebrating Black History Month and investing in strong futures for kids at aecf.org, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org, and by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
A move to include Asperger's within the definition of autism has raised concerns by families, doctors, educators, and the insurance companies. The latest on our understanding of Asperger's syndrome and why some want to keep the definition distinct. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. As we talk about recent events in Afghanistan, the cooperation of the Pakistan government with the CIA and NATO forces in capturing one of the top leaders of the Taliban. During the break, I was asking David Sanger where he thinks this man is being held. We really have no idea, do we, David?
Well, the Times story says that he was the lead in the capture was the ISI, which is the Pakistani intelligence arm. And so if he is in Pakistani control, I suspect, and this is pure guesswork, that he's probably at a Pakistani facility. That in some ways, given the debate at home about what one does with captured enemy combatants.
In order
and so
to
forth.
Achieve information.
Right. It is a little bit easier for the U.S. if he is, in fact, being held by the Pakistanis.
Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Flora. You're on the air.
Thank you. One of the most succinct comments I've heard on the insurgency came from an Arab woman who spoke on some television interview. This might have been 2 years ago. And she said, "You people have one or two children. We have seven, eight, or nine. How does one arrest an insurgency that's willing to have its own children used as sacrifices to the cause as suicide bombers, and they breed at such a prodigious rate. How does one keep up with that?
David.
You know, throughout the insurgencies that the U.S. has been facing, not only in Pakistan and Afghanistan, but throughout the Middle East and so forth, you know, there's always been the question that my colleague Tom Friedman puts so well, which is, what do you do if people love war more than they love their children? And I'm not quite sure how you answer that question. But the counterinsurgency strategy that the U.S. is pursuing, that the British pursued in Malaya, in when before it was called as it is today, Malaysia, is the same, which is that you try to appeal to people's desire to build a better community and a better life, and hope that if they see a path to that, it is more appealing to them than a radical ideology. And some places that works and some places it doesn't. But the lesson consistently in counterinsurgencies like this is that to change that mindset takes a decade or more.
Or a generation or more.
Or a generation or more. In the Mideast, you could argue many generations have gone by and that has not happened. And so you have to wonder whether the time scale that the United States talks about for its own political reasons, you know, 18 months before we begin to build down and so forth, matches the time scale of this kind of problem.
All right. To Rochester, Massachusetts. Good morning, Nicholas.
Good morning. Thank you. My comment and then a question. The comment is, disagree with Mr. Edeford, I think his name is, when he said we're not viewed as invaders. Malalai Joya, a member of parliament, and Matthew Ho, among others, disagree with that. They say that we are viewed as invaders. Secondly, my question has to do with this so-called government in a box that the general spoke of. These government officials that they bring in, will they be from that particular clan or tribe, or would they come from the outside?
All right, sir. Thanks for your call. That issue of seeing the U.S. as invaders, Carl.
Well, certainly some Afghans would, because the Afghans have a strong history of being against foreign intervention. You can ask the Soviet Union about that or the British about that and their attempts at empire. But 2001, removal of the Taliban was something strongly supported by the Afghan people. They had lived for years under that repressive rule. And they welcomed the U.S. Military, and they welcomed the insertion of the NATO forces. The civilian casualties has caused problems there, because then they start to say, why are they killing our people? But surveys, including one that I'm associated with, the Asia Foundation annual survey of the Afghan people, continue to see strong support, and from the leadership of Afghanistan, for continued presence if we do it right and if we put Afghans in the lead on this. And that's why Marja is important. Afghans are part of the 15,000 that have gone into that city. They are part with the U.S. and with the British. So incorporating the Afghans into this is terribly important, so we're not seen as invaders.
And, of course, there were nine casualties.
There were nine
casualties.
Among
civilians. And the U.S. was quick to acknowledge that they had been responsible and to apologize, David.
They have, and that is part of the counterinsurgency strategy, which is to, you know, there are going to be horrific mistakes made. There's a dispute in the case for these nine who were killed in a home that was struck by a missile about whether or not the missile was aimed at hit the wrong place, or whether it hit the place they intended, but they weren't aware that there were civilians inside.
And what about this question of the government in a box? Who is the government that's going to be in that box, David?
You know, in the briefings that I was reading from a distance here from General McChrystal, it wasn't clear to me who the government officials were going to be. But I thought the most interesting thing that I read in the Times' coverage from Afghanistan this morning was that a number of tribal leaders, about 10 tribal leaders, had gathered together over the weekend in a shura, and come to the conclusion that they had to support the American effort in Marja, and were making that clear to the American commanders who were there. And that's a very risky thing for them to do, because they know that if the Taliban come back into the town, the supporters of the American and Afghan troops there would be the first to be killed. But that indicates that at least some of the leadership in this area of, what, 100,000 people or thereabouts, recognize that over the long term, they've got a better shot with an alternative to the Taliban.
All right, to East Halsted, New Hampshire. Good morning, Mao. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I love your show.
Thank you.
I have a question or a comment that I've heard, and I actually heard this quite a while ago, and I imagine it's still true, that the amount that the Afghan soldiers and police get paid is quite miserably low. And the amount that a Taliban soldier gets paid for a day is like 5 or 10 times as much. And so, you know, first of all, you might say, well, where is all that money coming from for the Taliban, and how could we cut that off? But the other thing is, it would just seem to me that it would be benefit us to pay those police and soldiers more than the Taliban pays, and that kind of goes to your question about paying off or buying off the foot soldiers. A lot of them are doing it because it's a living.
Indeed. Carl Enderford.
The caller is absolutely right. We have been out-resourced by the Taliban on the question of payment for the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police, particularly the police. They were paid such a low wage that many of them are corrupt. Many of them have become not protectors but predators on the Afghan people themselves. So getting their salaries up to, if you will, a competitive wage is terribly important, and that is being done. That it was another thing discussed in London, to start paying the Afghan National Army and police a wage that will keep them and retain them and build up that security force so we can transfer it at a certain point to them.
David.
You know, this goes back to something that Carl mentioned earlier in our conversation, which is how Afghanistan became the secondary war, and sort of a distraction in the minds of the Bush administration to the Iraq War. And it was issues like this, things that seem so fundamental, things that seem so easy to figure out, that you've got to pay the Afghan soldiers more than the Taliban, that get to what that level of distraction was. And the reason for that, in part, is that the U.S. convinced itself in 2002 and 2003 that, in fact, the Taliban had been eviscerated, not just defeated, but was gone. Not that it had moved 50 miles over the border, but that they were gone. And it was that fundamental misjudgment that began this whole series of troubles.
David Sanger of The New York Times. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And here's an email from Jim, who says, why did President Karzai's recent call for truce or peace talks with the Taliban, why were they not taken more seriously? Won't there eventually have to be some kind of deal with the Taliban struck eventually? Carl.
Well, President Karzai is not giving up on this. He's going to convene a grand peace jirga in the next few months to try to bring in all of these elements of Afghan society that will be required to put that country back together. I do think that something that we heard earlier from the ambassador, from Ambassador Khalilzad, is important. These two approaches, reconciliation and reintegration, can work in tandem. You reintegrate those low-level fighters with jobs and economic incentives, but you try to reconcile at the top level, and that really is a process that the Afghans have to do themselves. It's good that the United States is not trying to be involved in bringing in high-level Taliban. They can't do that. Who can do that, and this is something that President Karzai is doing, he's reaching out to the Saudis. The Saudis have great connections with the Taliban. They once actually recognized the Taliban as a legitimate government of Afghanistan until they realized who they were dealing with. So let the reconciliation go ahead. It requires the tribals, the Pashtuns, the Tajiks, all of the tribal elements. But let the Afghans take the lead on that.
I must say, listening to Ambassador Khalilzad, you had the feeling that his hope was that Marja was going to be a turning point. At least that was my inference, that it was going to expand little by little by little and truly become a turning point in this relationship between the U.S., Afghanistan, and the Taliban. Do you believe that, David?
I do believe that that is the hope. One of the big questions is, can the United States, NATO, and the Afghan forces have enough well-trained troops on the ground in time to expand that area? Or does the limit in the number of troops require General McChrystal to do something more like he talked about during the Afghan review at the White House last fall, which is pick specific areas and go in and have sort of concentric circles and hope that they meet up, but not try to take over the entire country because they simply don't have the numbers for that. And even after the 30,000 additional American troops are there, there still won't be the numbers to control an area and a population of this size with a full counterinsurgency. So then the question is, how quickly can you bring truly trained Afghan troops up? One hopes that this is a better way to do it. But, you know, I remember standing out in the Rose Garden in early 2002, listening to President Bush and President Karzai. He was not yet President Karzai, but he was at that point the appointed American leader of Afghanistan, talk about the hundreds of thousands of Afghan troops they would have together in a year or two. And it simply didn't happen.
So what's your expectation, Carl?
Well, I think Marja can be a prototype for how to proceed with this new counterinsurgency strategy.
Sort of concentric circles.
Concentric circles and clear, hold, build, and transfer. That's a new mantra. And one thing we've been talking about, bringing in the government in a box to Marja, but they're also going to be bringing in several hundred, I've heard as high as 2,000 Afghan police to be part of that hold, so that when the Marines and the military forces depart for their next operation, that this simply will not revert back to Taliban control. So they will be bringing in not only administrators, but also police to start to provide security. And that can be a prototype for other operations. That's the hope.
I must say, as you talk about clear, build, hold, transfer, government in a box, these are all sort of words that may become meaningless to the people who are listening, whose sons or daughters, husbands are there in Afghanistan. How much longer is always going to be the question, Carl?
Well, again, this is a new strategy. President Obama went through a very long, some believe too long review. I actually think take the time that's necessary to make the right decision, so I was in favor of that. But that was his West Point speech was 2 months ago. And he and also General McChrystal have talked about a 12 to 18-month period, not to win this war. It's not a winnable war, but it is a war where there can be success and the momentum can change and all of the sacrifices that are being made can have a positive outcome. But this is only 2 months into a new strategy that is designed to go for 12 to 18 months. So this is the beginning phase. The fact that we've now seen the number two in the Afghan Taliban captured, that's a big plus. We need some breaks to go our way here.
David.
Well, these counterinsurgency efforts, as I said before, do take a long time, and they don't match up with the American political calendar of showing a lot of progress in 12 to 18 months. On the other hand, in Iraq, one saw a coming together of a very imperfect government. We're now worried about, you know, whether or not they are pursuing the democratic vision that Iraqi leaders talked about. In Afghanistan, it's much tougher than in Iraq, because Iraq, for all of the good and bad, had a history of a strong central government. There has never been that history in Afghanistan. And the big question is, can you hold it together as a country without a central government that is of the kind that we envision?
David Sanger, he's chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Carl Inderfirth, former Assistant Secretary of State for South Asian Affairs. He's currently Professor and Graduate Program Director at George Washington University's School of International Affairs. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, Diane. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.